Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Alejandra Bronfman. My guest today is Nicole Bourbonnais. She's the author of Birth Control in the Decolonizing Caribbean, published in 2016 by Cambridge University Press. This book is a wide-ranging examination of the implementation of birth control in the British Caribbean. Bourbonnais focuses on Bermuda, Barbados, Jamaica, and Trinidad to understand the ways that a range of actors, including colonial officials, feminist reformers and activists, and working class women, all shaped policies as well as practices related to control over reproductive lives. She tells these complex stories with the nuance and sense of humanity they warrant. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi, Nicole. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So we're going to start by talking a little bit about your own trajectory and your own sort of path towards becoming a historian of the Caribbean. But in the interest of full disclosure, I want to just tell our listeners that we've known each other for a long time. And I'm really just so delighted to be having this conversation with you. And so I'll also say that when I first met you, even when you were an undergraduate, you had a kind of very focused commitment to studying the Caribbean, which is pretty unusual in a place like Vancouver, British Columbia. So can you please tell us how you came to be a historian of the Caribbean?
Sure. Yeah, it's not obvious. I grew up in a small town in rural Manitoba, as you know, which is pretty distant from the Caribbean in a lot of ways. But when I was 18, I did one of these volunteer abroad programs. You know, one of these kind of when you're 18 and you think you're going to save the world. And I ended up in Guyana. Now, as you might have guessed, I didn't save the world. I mostly came away from the experience realizing how naive I was and how ignorant as well of about the Caribbean, maybe about life in general, but particularly about the Caribbean. And I came back to university in Vancouver, really just so fascinated by Caribbean history. I really, the more I learned about it, the more I kind of delved into it, the more interesting I found it kind of as a region, but also as a place where so much of global history happened too, you know, as this kind of crossroads of global history. And so, yeah, I just kind of kept taking it in my courses. Even if it wasn't a course about the Caribbean, I would end up writing a paper about the Caribbean somehow. Which was also fostered, obviously, by having some great professors of the Caribbean.
So the book itself covers debates and the implementation of birth control policies in the British Caribbean, right? So apart from the fact that we really needed a book like this, and it's kind of astonishing that one hadn't been written, how did you get the idea for it?
Yeah, so that was very random, I guess. I was interested in the Caribbean. And actually, I don't know if you remember this, but one summer I was working for you as a research assistant, mm-hmm. and you were having me look at microfilm of the Jamaica Gleaner in the years 1938, 1939. And I was looking for you for articles about the radio. But what I kept finding was articles about birth control. So I did find some radio stuff. It wasn't a total loss, but
you did.
But what really stood out to me was like every day there was an article about birth control, and this is in 1938, 1939. I went on to write my master's about this, and there was something like 360 or or 380 articles just in that 1 year alone on birth control. And so I was really struck by this, like, why are people talking about birth control in Jamaica in 1938? What does that even mean? I mean, what are birth control methods in 1938? And how did this play into the obviously heated tensions around labor, around nationalism, all of this kind of activism that was happening in these same years, 1938 being the year of a major labor rebellion in Jamaica. So that was kind of my initial interest. So it pulled me into the particular story of birth control, and then kind of went on from there. I decided to expand it to look at other islands because they kept coming up in the sources on Jamaica. So they were talking about what was going on in Bermuda, what was going on in Barbados, and Trinidad. And so I came to see the story as interconnected.
So you do this really brilliant thing at the beginning of the book. You start with a letter from Rose Gordon in Jamaica, and she says she's given birth 14 times, lost three children, and that she was, quote, a slave to childbearing, and also that she wanted to, quote, be free of this terrible strain. And then a few pages in, you drop kind of a bomb, which is that you have in your possession, or you looked at, 512 letters like this from women, right? Mm-hmm. And I want to get to all of those later. But I actually want to ask you about the structure of the book, because what happens is that you sort of set the stage with these women and this hint of these letters, but then you sort of pull back to debates among colonial officials, birth control activists, local newspapers, and all kinds of other actors. And the letters and the women really are at the heart of the third chapter. So we don't really get to them until the third chapter. And it's a kind of a, I was thinking about that. It's kind of, you build this sort of suspense, right? In terms of, okay, like, where are these women and what are they going to think about all of these debates, right? So so before we get to actually the story, I would love to hear you talk about how you decided to structure the book that way.
Yeah, I think, you know, I thought about that, actually. I remember one of the peer reviewers suggested that I move that section about the women earlier in the book. But for me, I felt that I needed to first explain how that clinic came to be in the first place, right? So before we can understand what women were doing there, what they expected from the clinic, what they were going to get at the clinic, who they were going to encounter there, I felt that first I needed to explain why this clinic opened, the politics around it, and the particular actors who were involved, the secretary of the clinic, the nurses, so that we could understand a bit that interaction. And it also, I think the structure of the book also follows the way that I encountered the story as well. So when I started obviously with the newspapers, as I mentioned. I was looking at legislative debates. I was looking at editorials, pamphlets, things that were published. And it was only about, I don't know, halfway through my first research trip that I actually came across the letters. And up until that point, I had really thought I was just going to tell a story about the politics of birth control, right? And about the discourses around it and how it kind of intersected with nationalism, colonialism, that kind of thing. And then when I found the letters, I was like, oh, okay, there's this whole other story here. There's this social history of birth control. There's, this material experience of birth control. And then I realized that that was a huge part of the story, and I wanted to tell that part too. So, yeah, I think it was partly just following my own path, and then partly I felt that it needed to be explained before we could understand the women's engagement with the clinic itself.
Yeah, so let's get into sort of the opening of the book with the 1930s and that setting. And I wonder if you can kind of paint a picture for us of how different groups fell on the question of birth control. I mean, there were a lot of really fascinating debates that you trace and kind of some surprising positions that people took. So I wonder if you could sort of sketch that out for us a little bit.
Sure. So on the one hand, as we might expect, the colonial office and many of the white elites on the islands of the Caribbean, across the different islands, latch on pretty quickly to neo-Malthusian and eugenic discourses of birth control, right? So the argument that the reason that the Caribbean is poor, the reason why there's this, discontent is because there's just too many people. The islands are overpopulated, and particularly there's too many of the wrong people, which is, you know, working class, obviously racialized understanding of who should and should not be born. So that discourse is there immediately and feeding into, you know, larger race class inequalities. Then there's also a discourse among kind of modernizing nationalists, both leaders like Norman Manley in Jamaica, Granly Adams in Barbados, Eric Williams in Trinidad, but also among public health professionals, among middle class actors with different kind of political leanings, who are arguing that birth control is not, you know, that overpopulation is not the only problem or necessarily even the main problem, but that helping people to have smaller families would be beneficial for development, for some of the plans that these actors have for a future that hopefully will not be a colonial future, right? So it becomes kind of connected to these nationalist aspirations and to kind of modernizing discourse. Then we have, on the other hand, some religious opposition among religious leaders, both Catholic and Anglican, although Anglican churches kind of officially by that period have accepted family planning in certain cases, you know, within marriage. But in the Caribbean, a lot of Anglican leaders came out against it because they argued that it was a different case in the Caribbean because so many children were being born out of marriage. So they argued that in this context, it would not be appropriate to promote birth control. So there's that religious opposition. And then there's also opposition among some Black nationalist groups, particularly among some members of the Universal Negro Improvement Association, or the UNIA. There's an argument that Marcus Garvey, although deceased at this point, would not have supported birth control, that he believed, you know, that it was a weapon against the poor, against the Black population. Of course, you know, you don't have to look far to find discourses like that, right? Because there, that eugenic neo-Malthusian discourse is being promoted in newspapers and legislative debates quite openly. So there's something there. But then what I found interesting is when you dive a bit closer into the UNIA debates and the debates among the Black community in the Caribbean, is that there's also these voices saying, okay, yes, of course we're against compulsory measures, we're against these kind of eugenic discourses and these eugenic plans, but voluntary birth control could in fact be very helpful to people as individuals. And some actors, particularly some of the women within the UNIA, make the argument that it's also a matter of women's rights. And this is a minority discourse within the region in the 1930s, 1940s. Obviously, it becomes prevalent later in the region and globally that birth control is a women's right. But there are some actors making this case early on. And there's also a couple of surprising, I would say, alliances. So at one point, the Bermuda government releases this report on unemployment where they suggest the compulsory sterilization of large swaths of the population, people with mental illness, people who have had illegitimate children. And both the Afro-Bermudian community and a group of suffragists, mostly dominated by white elite women, mobilize against this, along with religious leaders and along with some other actors to oppose it, and are successful in preventing it from being passed. Similar proposals also are not passed in Barbados and Jamaica. So on the one hand, it is, you know, a lot of the positions fall along kind of race, class, gender lines that you would expect. But then there's also this kind of broader complexity to the way people fall on this issue and where they come out in the debates.
Yeah, I want to get back to this question of, I was really fascinated by some of these women like Mamie Akin, for example, and I want to get back to them. But actually, first, I want to talk a little bit about the geography here, because you start with Bermuda, and Bermuda was actually one of the first places to get a birth control clinic, right? Mm-hmm. And so how did that, why, and also, you know, Bermuda as you point out, isn't always thought of as part of the Caribbean. So I think we need to talk about Bermuda a little bit.
Yeah. I decided to include Bermuda. It is kind of, you know, some people see Bermuda as part of the Caribbean, some people don't, for a variety of different reasons. I decided that Bermuda was really important to this story because it kept coming up in my other sources. So usually as either a example of kind of racial eugenics run amok, or as an example of, you know, what islands could be doing in order to limit families. So what Bermuda meant in the Caribbean when it came to birth control really depended on what your position was on birth control. But for example, there are protests against this house, this unemployment report that I mentioned. There are protests against that that run to New York, Caribbean communities in New York, Boston, and all the way down to Guyana. So this information about what's going on in Bermuda is important to the story and continues to be cited many, many years later, even long after. Now, part of the reason, I mean, Bermuda is one of the first places in the Caribbean, or it is the first place in the Caribbean that I know of to have a birth control clinic. It's also one of the first places in the world to have one that was supported with government funding. It's in 1934, so it's really early, or 1936, sorry. It's really quite early. And part of the reason this happens in Bermuda versus in other places is because at this time, although Bermuda is a colony of the UK, it's has a lot more independence to act locally because of its unique history, because it had a much larger white population. It was almost like in between a settler colony and a Caribbean colony. So it has this kind of unique structure that allows the government to act a bit more quickly in this field. Whereas in the other Caribbean islands, any kind of attempts to get funding for birth control from different associations, different actors who are organizing clinics is very quickly shut down by both local actors and by the colonial office.
So what about the other islands? You have Barbados, Jamaica, and Trinidad. How did you choose those, and what are the differences between them?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of differences between them. Of course, it's always hard when you do a comparative study to, you know, to not end up kind of washing over some of the differences. Jamaica, obviously, one of the most populated islands, kind of weighs heavily, you know, in the mind of the colonial office, kind of a lot of the time things that are happening in Jamaica then determine policy in other areas in this period. Very strong kind of nationalist labor movements in these years. Barbados was seen as a particular concern because it was one of the most densely populated islands. So a lot of this overpopulation discourse really starts earliest in Barbados and becomes really strong. And Trinidad obviously is distinct through its different kind of population dynamics. So having a large population of East Indians who came over after slavery ended through indenture. So they're all really different islands. I mean, the reason I picked them is really just because they were the places that seemed to move the most quickly in terms of establishing clinics, first in Bermuda, then in Jamaica, and then in the 1950s in Barbados and Trinidad. I actually found out quite a bit later that there was also a clinic in Bahamas in, I think, 1955 or somewhere around that. Unfortunately, too late to include that story in the book, but I think it would be really interesting. Apparently, it opened and then closed down very quickly, like within a year or something, due to opposition. And also, I would have to confirm this, but from the little source that I had, because apparently one of the clinic nurses got pregnant, which is, you know, never a good look when you open a birth control clinic. So, so there's probably other stories there. You know, maybe there are other false starts in other areas that just didn't attract my attention, but it was really driven by the story of birth control above all.
I mean, one of the things that's really interesting about this book and was seems really hard to pull off, which you do really well, is that it's not just a comparison, right? You don't just sort of sit there and put each island side by side, but you also show how many networks and connections there were between them all, right? So a lot of these activists were moving around and the newspapers moved around, and there was a sense of a kind of things, ideas, people, and even objects kind of circulating around. And I guess one of the things that seems to have been moving around a lot were these women who traveled or whose writings were kind of circulating in different circles and things like that. So I want to talk about some of these women, and these women who we kind of see over and over again, who pop up not just sort of as sources, but also as sources of sources. For instance, I think it was, wasn't it in the archives of one of these women that you found all of these letters? May Farquharson, maybe, and then also Mamie Akin. And so I want to hear you talk more about these women. How does the historiography look different if we sort of take their perspective?
Yeah, so May Farquharson, that was a huge source collection for me. She was the secretary of the Jamaica Birth Control League, which later became the Jamaica Family Planning Association. And in reality, she was the one who kind of did most of the organization of the clinic. There was a board of directors, but she was the person kind of on the ground. I think there's something like 10 boxes of hers at the Jamaica Archives. And it was one of those things where, I mean, this never happens. I never tell my grad students about this because it's not fair, but I literally arrived and the first binder I opened up at the Jamaica Archives was a list of all of her collection. Just, you know, an entire binder of documents on birth control. And I was like, oh, well, is this how archival research works? Great. It doesn't work that way normally. But yeah, so she has, she basically kept, I think, every letter she received and copies of every letter she wrote. So, and also clinic records, you know, balance sheets, shopping lists, everything. So it was an incredible collection to work with. Mamie Akin is much harder to track down. Obviously, they have completely different profiles, right? So May Farquharson was the daughter of a sugar estate owner. She's a very wealthy, elite white woman, tons of resources, and, you know, the privilege of kind of having her collection taken by the archives. Mamie Akin was someone whose traces I kind of found mostly through looking in newspaper articles, kind of tracking her down through that. There's also been some great stuff written about her by scholars of African American history because she lived in the United States for a while. And so you can see that she does circulate quite a bit between the U.S. She spent some time in the Central America before she ends up in Jamaica. And even then, she kind of goes back at one point to the U.S. and learns more about birth control, visits birth control clinics, etc. But she's not as involved in the daily work of the clinic. There, it's more run by May Farquharson in the Jamaican case. But as in other cases of the other clinics as well, it's really doctors and nurses who are doing most of the work. Right. So usually a woman doctor in most of these clinics and a whole bunch of nurses who themselves usually come from working or middle class backgrounds. And so I do think that it really shifts to look at their papers and to look at the work being done by these women in the clinics, shifts it from being a story just about, you know, neo-Malthusian eugenic politics, to being also a story about, you know, nurses, some of whom themselves came from large families and were driven by the desire to help women like their mothers. You know, this is this kind of whole other element of the story that I think would have been totally lost if I had just focused on the political arena.
Yeah, I wanted to talk more about the nurses because I do think that they're fascinating. I don't know if you have one or two in particular that you remember, but it struck me that they are really translators in so many ways, right? About knowledge and about bodies and about sort of, okay, let's take this, you know, whatever it is that the colonial officials or the you know, the sort of more middle class elite are throwing at us, and let's how do we actually implement this on the ground and make sure it's the best thing possible for the women that we're serving. So I don't know if you have more sort of specific nurses or how you thought about nurses when you were writing this.
Yeah, there was one stack of letters in particular between Nurse Campbell and I don't even know her first name, to be honest. It only just was referred to as Nurse Campbell, but Nurse Campbell and May Farquharson in May Farquharson's collection. And it's really interesting because, okay, May herself is a very complicated character, to say the least. And she definitely has some eugenicist, some neo-Malthusian kind of tendencies to her. She kind of vacillates between putting forward this kind of public health, social welfare approach, but also gets very easily frustrated, particularly when birth control doesn't kind of immediately catch on. And Nurse Campbell kind of, in this correspondence, is constantly writing to her like, look, okay, it's going to take a while. You know, people are coming from these backgrounds. She's trying to kind of defend the women that are coming to the clinics and help them with some of their problems. But then also sometimes in the records, she's kind of trying to negotiate for better salaries as well. So a couple of times she threatens to quit or does actually quit and takes up a job somewhere else. She, from the little bit of background I could find on her, she also was involved in some kind of labor movements and things like that. So she has her own story. I wish that I had better sources on that. And I think if I went back and did the book over again, I would have really tried to do an oral history project with nurses who were involved, at least in some of the later years of these clinics, because I think there is really a deeper story there about the role of nurses and the way that they navigated, you know, this intermediary position.
Yeah, they seem to be, they're sort of between, you know, male doctors often and patients, and they're really fascinating, I think. So we move towards the 1940s and the Moyne Commission, and you make a pretty good case that kind of shifts the terrain a great deal. So I wonder if you can sort of talk about that and what difference did the Moyne Commission make, and how did that change things with regards to birth control?
I think the Moyne Commission, so this was the kind of investigation launched by the Colonial Office after the labor rebellions in the Caribbean to kind of find out what was the cause of the unrest and why, what could be done about it. And I'm not sure that the Moyne Commission really changed so much in the debates within the Caribbean, but it definitely led to a Colonial Office obsession with overpopulation. I mean, I don't even know how else to put it. I went to the Colonial Archives in Kew, and there were like 50 folders on overpopulation and birth control in the Caribbean, which is even more surprising when you find out that they didn't actually do very much at all about birth control in the Caribbean. So they just wrote a lot of memos and a lot of pamphlets that never got published and, you know, came up with these schemes of what they were going to do. But really, it comes out first, I think, most strongly in the Moyne Commission, where there's some of the commissioners, when they're interviewing, you know, local people across the Caribbean, are really like badgering them about overpopulation. So some of them will be talking about something and the commissioner will interrupt them and say, well, but do you think it's okay to be asking for these things when you're having so many children and fertility rates are out of control, you know? So they're really aggressive. Some of them are really aggressive about it. And then a few colonial officials afterwards make this almost like their personal mandate within the Colonial Office to try and get some support for intervening, providing birth control, or encouraging local governments to get involved. But really the farthest that they go is at one point they send around a circular encouraging, you know, local governments to take some action, and they get mostly negative responses, and they admit in the end that it was kind of totally pointless to send this circular. The other thing that they do is to provide some funding for fertility studies, particularly the Jamaica Family Life Project, which was headed by American demographer J. Myon Stikos. And this does have some effect. Actually, it has a stronger effect, I would say, in the long run, because the studies basically showed that many Jamaican women did want to have less children, you know, were open to birth control. And this in the late 1950s ends up having an effect on political debates and political opportunities. But the colonial office wasn't very happy with it. They didn't feel that they had enough control over this study. They didn't really have much control at all. And they didn't feel that it was really strong enough in its proposals. So I guess the Moyne Commission kind of starts that really powerful discourse within the colonial office of overpopulation being the problem, but they don't actually do much in the end.
I think it sort of highlights the way that you framed it in the chapter itself. And I'm just going to read a little quote. The colonial office's approach to birth control highlights both resistance to the colonial state's interventionism and disappointment with its ultimate failure to deliver on its civilizing mission. So basically they are getting more and more kind of ham-fisted, is what you're arguing. They can't do anything right.
I guess it fits with the larger, right, after the Moyne Commission and in the 1940s, they launched this development and welfare program that's supposed to address all these problems and maybe hedge off, you know, the independence movements. But of course, it doesn't. I mean, it's too little too late, right, to kind of try and invest in social welfare and health in the dying days of empire. And birth control kind of follows that trajectory as well, right? It also just kind of dies out.
Right. So finally, we get to the letters in chapter 3. So you've set all of the, like, you've really set us up well to appreciate the weight and the importance of these letters. And as you mentioned, I mean, these really are every dissertator's dream, right? Just kind of like amazing, amazing source. And so I wonder if you can talk a little bit about them. And also, I mean, you first read them some years ago, right? So which ones are there any that you really remember that stand out to you that you think you're going to not forget?
It's honestly, it was really hard to read the letters. I mean, some of them are kind of optimistic and, you know, we've just gotten married and we want to not have, you know, children so quickly, that kind of thing. But most of them were really, really quite intense. I mean, women talking about having a child every year. There's women who talk about feeling completely hopeless, who talk about feeling like they can't go on, they can't live anymore, you know? The woman, as you mentioned, that I start with talks about being a slave to childbearing, which, especially in the context of the Caribbean, with the history of slavery, it just seems so powerful to me to use that language. There's also women who talk about having had, who are already pregnant and are asking for something to end the or to interrupt the pregnancy. I think they all, really, the sum total of them all, really, were so intense to read and really. Obviously, this wasn't everybody's experience. These are 500 letters out of, you know, millions of women in the Caribbean. So, you know, these are often the kind of most desperate cases who would come to the clinic. You know, women on average who were older, had more children, had them quicker. But I think it was still really gave you a sense of the gravity of reproduction in this period. And the intensity of trying to have a family, but not so quickly, as one put it. One woman, I remember one letter, the woman said, "I'd like to have my lot, you know, the amount of children I'm supposed to have, but not so quickly," right? So she manages to kind of still hold on to kind of cultural ideals of childbearing, but make the point that let's just like slow it down a little bit. This is a bit intense.
So how would you, I mean, if we're sort of looking back now on these clinics, I'm wondering how we would talk about in terms of, you know, did they work, right? So on the one hand, it's very clear that what they offered was a sense of control and empowerment to a certain sense to these women who actually really wanted and asked for birth control. But on the other hand, you do point out that often, you know, the methods they used didn't work very well, or they were still in experimental phases, or, you know, all kinds of things happened, right? So the bigger picture of sort of, you know, how would you assess the role of these clinics in the end?
Yeah, I think even the clinics themselves at the time saw themselves as kind of pilot projects, you know, a space to start giving women methods and kind of show that there was demand. I think everybody recognized that one clinic in one town was not going to, you know, make a big change overall in women's lives. And I think from the limited amount that you can tell from reading these sources or some of the other records I had from other clinics, you can definitely see that there are some women who find it, you know, really exciting, and it meets their needs. And, you know, they're successful using the diaphragm, for example. But much more often is a story of disappointment and of ultimately, I think in most of the clinics, like half the women never came back even once, maybe, you know, to get more supplies. There was a lot of failures with the methods. I mean, they were not great methods, to be honest. I mean, I think about what involved, I mean, there were like, you know, spermicidal foams and powders that would burst out of their tubes in hot weather. And, you know, these diaphragms that you had to like fit perfectly over your cervix somehow, and then you'd leave it in overnight, and then you'd have to hang it up the next day. And, you know, where did you hang your diaphragm if you lived in a small house? You know, it just, the practicalities of it were pretty complicated. And sometimes the, you know, nurses and doctors weren't particularly sympathetic. You know, as I was saying, May Farquharson, for example, would get so frustrated with people who couldn't use these methods. But when I look at them, I'm like, I wouldn't be able to use those methods. That seems very complicated and unpleasant. You know, some of them had smells. One of them, I remember there was some complaints in the clinic in Bermuda because the Volpar paste, one of the pastes, was labeled poison on the label. So, I mean, you know, you can kind of understand why people were not necessarily that satisfied. So I think overall, it wasn't usually the solution that it was sometimes projected as, right?
I wonder, actually, this question just popped up in my mind as we were talking about these different kinds of methods. And did you come across anything in your sources about, you know, alternative methods that were not kind of coming from Western medicine and those kinds of things, or, you know, herbal practices that people had been using for many years and things like that?
Yes. So mostly in the case of abortifacients, I think that's how you say that word. So methods that would be aimed at interrupting a pregnancy, or as it was often kind of seen at the time, as bringing on a delayed period, right? So there's a bit of a, people often don't talk about it in that period as bringing about an abortion, but rather just as bringing on a period that was late. And of course, in the kind of 30s, 40s, 50s, people aren't getting pregnancy tests after one missed period. You know, there aren't pregnancy tests. So you don't really know you're pregnant often until you really start to show kind of physical signs. So this created that little bit of space to, you know, bring on a period as a birth control method, even if we would now probably consider that an abortion method. But there are some evidence of women using these types of methods, different herbs. I can't remember them exactly, but I think pennyroyal, which is also something that in other contexts was used. There's also, I remember the birth control, one of the birth control clinics in Barbados talks about how women would say they'd had a slip, which would either mean that they kind of slipped and fell and provoked an abortion, or slipped something into the uterus to provoke an abortion. And this is, I mean, common to all over the world, right? Any country you go to in this period is going to have different methods, physical, inserting things into uterus or herbal to provoke abortions. Some of the works on slavery have shown how women carried on methods from Africa to the Caribbean that they used in provoking abortions. So there are definitely those kinds of methods available. And some of the letters sort of speak to that. So they'll say, okay, I'm pregnant. Could you send me something to bring or to prevent this one from developing or something like that? Mm-hmm. So there's obviously this knowledge of it.
So you wrap the book up by zooming back out, right? And it brings in, you bring in USAID and really what you represent as a kind of general and more broad acceptance and practice of birth control. There's still issues and controversies, but really it seems to be something that more and more people have access to and almost take for granted. And what's interesting is that you've really unpacked and really shown the process and the messiness and the contingency of that, right? And the way in which people may take it for granted now, but there was a whole lot of stuff that happened beforehand. So I wonder if you can talk about what you think this particular perspective adds and contributes to the historiography of decolonization.
Sure. I mean, I think on the one hand, it shows that decolonization was also about these kinds of struggles, right? So it was about labor, it was about class, about race, about global inequality, but it was also about gender, and it was about how families are made and what kind of families were needed for, you know, nation states, for independence. So there is this kind of, I think it sort of shows the gendered politics of decolonization and how those intersected with race and class debates as well. But it also shows that decolonization did matter. I don't know if that's a weird thing to say, but I feel like there's often a lot of critiques of like, okay, there were still all these problems afterwards. But at least in the case of the Caribbean, in the case of birth control, I don't think it ever would have happened under British colonial rule. You know, there was just, there was that, you know, it wasn't democratic. There wasn't the possibility for these different actors to be part of governments that could then push for birth control, right? I mean, a lot of the reason why birth control comes to be accepted as government policy in the Caribbean is because these nurses, doctors, social workers end up becoming part of governments or have links to people in government that can then kind of push forward these policies. Sometimes even against powerful opposition from church leaders, for example. Eric Williams' election in Trinidad in 1956, for example, is I think it's 1956. I'm really bad with dates for a historian, but is a really good example because the Catholic Church really mobilizes strongly against him because for many reasons, but partly because he had been on record as supporting birth control, but he wins, you know, and therefore there is this space to promote those kinds of policies. So, yeah, I guess that's kind of how it intersects with decolonization in a few different ways.
Yeah, and theoretically you make a really sort of elegant point that the discourse of birth control was both coercive and offered openings for people. And that's very persuasive sort of throughout the book. But then you sort of towards the end, there's a kind of warning about sort of, you know, the future of all of this. And you say until internal race and class disparities and the unequal position of the Caribbean islands in the world system are fully addressed, reproductive politics will remain a potential flashpoint in the region. So sort of looking back and then looking forward, obviously we have not solved the race and class disparities or probably the position of the Caribbean islands in the world system. So where do we stand today with these kinds of issues?
Yeah, I mean, listening to you say that sentence, that could probably be said of anywhere in the world, as we can obviously see. You know, I mean, the abortion law context in the US right now, right? Like reproduction is just always this potential political tool, this political weapon, because it touches, because it touches on this extremely intimate aspect of people's lives, right? It's easy to get passionate about one way or another because it's about reproduction as a, you know, family, as a species. So it's always kind of there. I think one of the kind of main points I wanted to make in the conclusion is that it also just takes so many different levels to ensure that something is empowering and not coercive, right? On the one hand, it takes, you know, funders and governments that don't set targets that lead to, you know, unethical practice. It also takes doctors and nurses who really give free choice, who are really about their patients' interests rather than about, you know, what they think is best for the patient, whether they should use this method or not. And it takes women having the resources and the networks to really assert themselves and what they want. And at all of these different levels, things can go one way or another. And so I think as much as, you know, we should rightly celebrate the way that discourse around reproduction has changed in many cases, there's also this feeling that unless that's embraced at every level, and there's kind of this need for constant vigilance, I think, at every level to ensure that that's what the commitment is, and it can always go back, it can always get retangled in all of these other issues.
So I've taken up lots of your time. I have one last question, and it's a question that I love to ask people because I'm always like beautifully surprised. So what are you working on next? What's your new project?
Well, I'm still obsessed with family planning, so and this movement. So I talk a little bit in the book about some of the international advocates who came to the Caribbean to kind of get involved in local movements. Margaret Sanger from the U.S., Edith Halmartin from the U.K., and then later Naomi Thomas from the U.S. And also about how the Caribbean gets involved in international organizations like the International Planned Parenthood Federation. And I was very interested about, you know, what are these people doing in the Caribbean, and what are the Caribbean actors getting out of these relationships with international activists? And so for my next book, I'm kind of shifting from looking, you know, at the Caribbean to looking at these international actors in themselves as a kind of cohort. So the International Planned Parenthood Federation, the Pathfinder Fund, the Population Council, all these different organizations that arise in the mid-50s and become these, that kind of build these networks, fund research, support local activists in different ways. And so I'm kind of looking at how these actors who were often, these organizations who are often composed of doctors, nurses, social workers, that kind of strata of intermediary actors, and how they kind of visualized this global movement in different ways, how they reacted to kind of local challenges, and how they dealt with the suddenly kind of dramatic rise in funding for family planning in the mid-60s onwards with USAID and other organizations or other kind of major donors getting involved. So really looking at this global family planning movement, how people tried to kind of spread, they called it the gospel of family planning around the world, and what actually happened on the in practice with that, right? So yes, the politics, but also again, what happened when you actually went to some other country and tried to talk about birth control, you know, to people? What were the reactions? What were the material realities of that movement?
I can't wait to read that book.
Thank you so much. I'm trying to write it right now.
Well, good luck with that. And thank you so much. I've really, really enjoyed talking about this to you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks so much for listening, and see you next time.